Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and WNST.net. This is a Baltimore positive segment. We are putting together some stuff through the holidays here and talking about issues and talking about crime and talking about people with voices. And recently, Don Moeller and I saw a piece in the Baltimore Sun. The headline was Apathy and Ignorance on Baltimore Crime. It was authored by a Joseph Jacalone. And we have him on the line right now. Joe Jacalone is a retired NYPD detective sergeant. You can find his work out at the Department of Law, Political Science, and Criminal Justice Administration at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Joe, first off, welcome in. Happy holidays to you. We give love to our sponsors like Fadley's and Jennings, and everybody can find stuff here. You're one of the rare people we're actually calling sort of out of market to talk about fixing our market. We're going to be doing more of that as we get up on the election in the springtime to say where are solutions, where are answers to problems that, quite frankly, are decades, if not centuries old here in Baltimore. But I know you got published here and you have a very, very strong take on Baltimore's problems and solutions.
Yes. Yeah. Good afternoon, guys. And yes, and thank you for having me, and happy holidays to you and your family.
Too. Same to you.
I have been, contemplating writing an op-ed like that in Baltimore. I actually had another one last year, which was about the overtime and things that could be done. And it just seems as if, things need a little push along sometimes. So I know I'm an outsider. And you know what? I know the outsiders aren't looked upon very nicely sometimes. But I'm an outsider with experience, and I've been an outsider that has, some skin in the game, so to speak. I've seen this happen. I've seen it work. And just because I'm retired now, that doesn't, I serve the communities in New York City for over 20 years. And you just don't get out of the fact when you retire about caring about people and seeing things that you think are mistakes and things that that you believe could be fixed.
Joe, well, just curiously, I hadn't even thought about this till this moment. Were you in New York when our former police commissioner Norris was there?
I believe so. I got on the job in 1992.
Okay.
So I believe that he was there during that time.
Okay. Well, one of the things that got our attention is, I'm going to jump right in, you basically say in Baltimore, and I'm assuming other large urban centers, we're not getting it right. We're on the wrong track. And I also, though, gathered a sense of optimism. And you said, but it's not impossible, and you can get it right. So tell us what we're doing wrong and what we ought to be doing.
Sure. And it's not so much what you're doing wrong. I mean, people look at New York City and say, wow, how did it get that way? In 1994, we had nearly 2,400 homicides, and this year they're spiking a little bit. They're probably over 300, but when you think about the sheer numbers from 2,400 to 300,
we're over 300 already, by the way. We crossed 300 the second week of November here in Baltimore with a resident, 600,000 residents, so yes.
Right. Yeah, and you look at a place like New York City that has over 8 million, or maybe even close to 9 million residents, so the crime rate of especially for homicide is off the charts when you compare the two. So you would think in a much smaller area you'd be able to pull this off. But what I've seen not only in Baltimore, but we see it in Chicago, we see it in Philadelphia, and in other places, is that they've abandoned the idea of doing police work. They're, like I said in the op-ed, politicians are more worried about something going bad or something happening like the Freddie Gray incident or some other incident that happens that the optics on it are just so terrible that they're afraid of the backlash and the riots and those kind of things. So they kind of like stick with the status quo or the ignorance of the whole thing or the apathy of the whole thing.
Well, the status quo of 300 murders here is that's not a status quo that can stand here.
Well, I mean, if you look, you shouldn't be. But if you listen to what the mayor said about, that it's not his fault that he wasn't doing the murders and neither was the police commissioner nor the city council, I guess that's comforting to know that they're not doing
it. Well, that got, it's interesting,
That
got quite a reaction, not only in the city and in the region. And as I say, as a former elected official, I know there are times that when we speak and we wish we could take those words back. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. But Joe, I want to push back, and we pushed back this morning with one of the mayoral candidates in asking this question. When you and others say, we're not doing the police work, I guess the question that is challenging urban centers all across the nation is, How do we do the police work during a time when we know, and again, I'm from a family of law enforcement officials myself, that we rely and we have to respect and hold in the highest regard the work that the police do, but at the same time knowing that there have been examples of police overreach that have created tension in our communities. So how do we strike this balance of having the police keep us safe at the same time not overstepping the line?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, there isn't any reason why we can't do constitutional policing and be able to reduce crime all at the same time. Those two should not be mutually exclusive. So you shouldn't say, well, we, in order to fight crime, we have to break the rules.
Well, we have the consent decree here, too, that, you know, 90% of our citizens probably don't understand. You know, I'm just trying to get through the point of understanding it, but things are different here.
Well, sure. I mean, the consent decree actually just lists out the things that, you know, the police should have been doing all along. I mean, the question that comes down to it when you look at it, the Baltimore police has some definite problems within the rank and file itself. There's been a corruption issues that they've had. They've had some other issues that they had to deal with, but they haven't really been dealing with. And just for an example, you've had a number of police commissioners in a short period of time, and I can't recall in any of my research any mass, lopping off of the top. So when you have an executive come in and take over and make no staff changes or very few staff changes, I kind of question that, because if you look at the last 5 years, you've had over 1,600 people murdered now in Baltimore, and you still have the same people in charge. They're not working out right. Something's not going on. Their plans aren't happening, or their police work or their supervision or what have you is not working. So that would be a thing that I would definitely be.
Well, we've had several commissioners here, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, wherever the mid and upper level management would be, down to the rank and file officers, I live in the center of the city. I walk through every day. I literally was at an event literally last weekend, a crime reduction and departmental transformation plan. I'm actually holding it up. It's on my desk. It was just within arm's reach. Just happened to literally be here to put you on. But it's a pretty comprehensive. I mean, I sat in a 45-minute speech with Police Commissioner Harrison, and I heard his New Orleans accent as nice as I hear your New York accent. So I think in Baltimore, and I speak as a citizen, if anyone here had the solution, we'd have been on that. So, you know, if I run for mayor, if someone's here from mayor and says, I'm going to bring a guy in from New Orleans or South Jersey or Pennsylvania, where you now reside, I think I want to hear about some place where it worked. And I think Harrison at least has that credential in the aftermath of Katrina for what that city went through in the aftermath of Freddie Gray here, or what's happened out in St. Louis or some other communities that have been broken and riotous and uprising and all of that. That you would like to hear that something different is going to happen.
And people are pulling for the commissioner to be successful.
You have to.
People are really...
As a citizen, we have to trust the police, but not all factions of the community can feel that way when... I mean, the Souter case here, I don't know if you're familiar with that, Joe.
Yes,
but
I am.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that there is a 50-50 pushback on either direction as to what really happened there. And maybe that, you know, goes along the line with impeachment, everything else in our country down the middle. But the belief here is that the cops haven't done it the right way in a lot of cases here, or in too many cases. And, you know, we had Maggie McIntosh on a couple weeks ago. She says that one of the real burdens of the next mayor is going to be paying the bills, the liability for all the things that went wrong with police in the community, that it's going to cost tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to make that
right. I mean, the gun task force, which we've talked about a number of times, one of the biggest scandals probably in law enforcement. In the history of law enforcement across the nation.
So trusting out-of-town people like you, I don't feel like who's this out-of-town guy writing an op-ed. I'm like, hey, tell me more, Joe, you know?
Joe, I want to ask you. Go ahead.
Yeah, New York City, we were going through the same issues in the late 80s and 90s with the corruption problems, and we had the Dirty 30, the 30 cops from the 30th Precinct in Upper Manhattan. We had those same issues. We had the riots in Washington Heights. We had riots in Washington Heights. These were all happening in 1989, 87, you know, up until 1992 and 93. We were having the same kind of issues.
And Rodney King was obviously a huge story then, right?
Well, yeah, Rodney King was out in L.A. That was during all that other stuff. But, you know, in New York specifically, we had the same kind of issue. So if you look at the Freddie Gray incident, we had our own kind of incidents in New York City, Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and like I said, in Washington Heights, where somebody said that the cops executed this known drug dealer, and it ended up all being a false story, but they burned, you know, half of Washington Heights down to the ground over 3 or 4 days. So we've seen this already. And if you think that you can't get the community's trust, I think one of the problems that I always see is that we never talk to the people actually within the community, how they really feel about the police. Instead, we take the sometimes self-appointed leaders of the community who tell us that the police aren't doing a good job, or we hear from our prosecutors that, you know, the police are not doing a good job and what have you. But the people that have to live in fear, live with the drug dealers and the murders, those are the people I think that, you know, they're probably very quiet about it because they don't want to get, you know, hurt themselves. But I think that they will have a favorable view of the police. And I think that if you look at some of the similarities between 1992 New York City and Baltimore currently today, I think you see a lot of similarities. And listen, let's put it this way. 5 years of 1,600 homicides with, you know, 600,000-700,000 people, like you said, live in this place. It's not working, whatever they were doing. So, you know what? What's the problem about trying something different or something that's already worked?
Well, you know, Joe, you were very specific in your op-ed, and one of the things you were critical about, and I'd like you to explain these two things to folks and then explain why you were critical. And again, we're going to have all sides on these issues. You were critical of something called microzones, and then you were also critical of the use of spy planes. So talk about both of those items and why you don't think they're effective crime-fighting tools.
Okay, so let's cover the spy planes first, too, because it's really about boots in the ground and getting your intelligence tree back up in order. So finding out where your hot spots really are. So, for instance, I believe I saw on Twitter a little while ago, you had another homicide on the same corner that you had one a few months back. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that makes me nuts, because you say to yourself, how can you as the police department not have that area surveilled or have a foot posts or anything else in that location since you already had that problem?
We saw a number that 86% of these crimes we're not finding the murderer, the trigger person. I find that to be incredible in a world where corners like that should have, that there should be a camera functioning there to see what happened, right?
Well, sure. I mean, listen, I think many people don't help the police for a couple of reasons. One, the cops have been painted with such a bad picture that nobody wants to help them or trust them. That's one thing. The second thing is they're fearful of the bad guys that live in their neighborhood. So for them to even try to reach out to the police. But here's an example of maybe having Crime Stoppers, having an anonymous tip line or tip source. If you have one, to be able to use it extensively, provide money to people who want to come forward and help out. There are other ways to get around the no snitching rules that they have out there out of the street. But, you know, more importantly for me is when you're having crimes happening in the same locations over and over again and you're not prepared to deal with that. So, for instance, taking, you know, we had this thing called the model block. And you took basically a block at a time where you had a lot of drug dealing or prostitution or shootings or what have you. You took a block at a time and you left the cop behind. And that cop would be out there for weeks or months out on end until things started to change. I mean, yeah, I know personnel is an issue when you can't leave cops and everything behind everywhere you go. But if you look at, I guess if we could overlay a map of the city and find out where all the shootings are occurring, I think we can find, between the three of us, we could find places and say, like, you know, there should be a cop here, a cop there. They call it cops on the dot. You know, I think maybe he was referring to that as a micro zone, whatever the snap, but sometimes his micro zone or something that's small like that, the problem is much larger than just that little area. So what else is going on around it? What's the reasoning behind it? Is it gangs? Is it drugs? Those are generally the two big things that are happening out there.
But sound to me, Joe, that you are a proponent, and we hear this over and over, you certainly are a proponent of the effective use of data in identifying trends and hotspots, and then bring in the appropriate resources to those areas.
Absolutely, and you need to bring those resources in rapidly, not a year later and you have another shooting, or 6 months later you have another shooting and they say, hey, maybe we should do something about it. So, yeah, I'm a proponent of this. I guess if you want to call it like in baseball with the money ball, right, just looking at the data and examining it and try to do all those things. Back in the day, when this thing all first kicked off, I mean, computers were just starting. You knew where the corners were. You knew who the players were because you had cops out there who were. You have some great cops, I'm sure, in the Baltimore Police Department that could tell you exactly who the players are, what's going on, what they're doing, and what happened. Are we listening to them, or do we just have this top-down approach where everything filters down from the top into the lowest level, the cops on the bottom, and nothing ever goes up? That's generally the way police departments work. But you know what? Things changed for us in New York City. We were listening to the cops. We were getting that data and the intel from the cops that had the sector cars and the community policing posts. And then you can map out that data and find things going on. And then if you want to look at it as targeting some, individuals that you know are doing this stuff, I don't see that as a problem of being in violation of the consent decree or anything else. It's called police work. But what? You can do it constitutionally. You just have to do it. It seems as if, like I said, people just don't care.
And you've been very clear. I want you to have a chance to articulate this. In no way, when I read your piece, are you an apologist for rogue cops? I think you take a hard line, right? That if we have rogue cops, I mean, get rid of them, I think you said.
Yeah, if they found out that these guys, that Mosby says she has guys that are not alike, if the internal investigation or they can prove that these cops lie, fire them and let's move on from this already. Yeah, no, listen, and even in the other...
Well, the union has another view on that, right? I mean, that's part of the hang-up with where we really are, where I go out and we're going to have police commissioner on next month.
And we hope to have the head of the FOP on to talk about it from their perspective.
And it's just, it's gotten ugly already out in the street, and obviously there's a murder every day, right? So, on top of that, the news media here has not taken a very, positive light on any of this other than... And you pick up some mud, they pick up some mud, everybody's throwing mud, Mosley's throwing mud. I don't know that we're doing anyone any service here, Joe.
No. No, and that sucks, but you know what? I specifically did address that in the op-ed because of the fact that part of the problem that we think that we have between the police and the community is the distrust and the gang and the gun task force and the corruption and stuff like that and the Souter case that's been hanging over their heads, even though the state has now said it was suicide. People still don't want to believe them. So we had an independent police department come in there and take a look at it, and they don't trust them either. So this is becoming a bigger problem than we can ever imagine. I'm all for cleaning up the department. You have to, if you have bad cops and real cops, you got to get rid of them. Right. And you know what? It all starts with your recruitment and your selection, too.
We hear that.
So that they don't get hired in the first place.
Yeah, we hear that all of the time. The other thing that I was struck by is there are themes. Nestor and I are always looking for themes. And a number of our guests talk about this next theme, and you zero in on it as well. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about it. And that is, you said, you better be focusing and stay on top of your parolees. And we hear that over and over. Tell us, from your perspective, why that's a crime-fighting technique.
Well, part of your parolees is that they've already been involved in some sort of violent crime that they have to be on supervision. So they tend to know what's happening within those areas. They can be a good source of intelligence for the ones that do stay straight. And unfortunately, the reoffending rates are probably pretty high, just like they are everywhere else. So if you have...
How are we getting that wrong, by the way? How are we screwing that up?
Well, I think that the parole officers and the probation officers' job, I think they just have too many people that they need to keep track of effectively. So their span of control is probably a lot more than it should be. And I think if we spoke to one of them, I think that would be their first.
Okay, but even someone who sort of wants to be on the straight and narrow and doesn't want to go back into the hole and like all of that, the support that person gets other than a parole officer, how are we getting that wrong, that them picking up a gun and winding up back in prison for the same stupid nonsense and hurting more people? Why is that the only attractive option these folks have? How are we getting that wrong?
Well, because sometimes we let people out of jail who either A, aren't ready to be let out yet just because their time is up, or they didn't have a plan for them for trying to find a job or having a job for somebody to keep them busy. Yeah, we're going to have a huge problem here with this in New York City with this, let everybody out of jail early kind of bit. There's not enough people who are going to be able to watch them. There's going to be lack of supervision. But here's the other thing. When you get released back on parole, you get released back to the zip code that you came from. That's the way it is in New York. I'm pretty sure it's probably the same in Baltimore. So if you send people back to the communities that are already struggling and there's no opportunity for them. There's no jobs. There's no
that seems to be the key.
Go to school. I mean, what do you expect people to end up doing? And if they've been in jail for the last 20 years, what do you think that all they've learned about is probably sometimes how to be a better criminal?
Yeah, we had a mayoral candidate today, Joe, talked about some real hard data about a program that an individual judge has initiated on their own, which is upon release, it's contingent upon getting involved with a mentor and a job training program and an employment. And the amazing statistics there was, I want to say, only 6% of those folks reentered the system versus 73 of those without the support. So there seems to be some data supporting your idea that when you release people, they've got to have a plan. You just can't send them back.
Right. Well, I didn't have any of that research data. I just had what I refer to as anecdotal data, right, from the people that I always ran into or had to deal with, especially investigating violent crimes. If they don't, I guess the old saying, the devil works in idle hands. If you can't keep people busy or you can't keep them on the straight and narrow, it's just easier for them to turn back to a life of crime in that respect. So, yeah, if the research backed it up, great. I mean, I always get beat up for saying things and people say, well, where's the research? Well, I experienced it. I think the experience sometimes is a lot more valuable than research, yes, especially something any academic can drag.
Some
up.
Of it's gut. Real quick, Nestor's passion, he'd kick me if we let you get away without saying, how do we get the daggone guns off the street, Joe?
Well, listen, law enforcement themselves can't do the job by themselves. We need to have some federal intervention, and we need to start going. And here's the problem, and this is something that always gets people on top of my case. We are not enforcing the gun laws that we have. People aren't getting the mandatory minimums that they deserve. They're being arrested with a gun, released right away, no bail or no anything, and then they're right back out on the street doing this thing. And unfortunately, until the prosecutors like Mosby and everybody else starts to really hit people hard and start hitting them with the deterrence factor, saying that if you get caught with an illegal gun in Baltimore, it's a mandatory 3 years and you're not going to do a day less than that. Until you start doing that, I think people will continue to flout the laws. But you also need the federal government involved in some of these things and going after the gun traffickers and going after some of the loopholes that are in the system already and just do things that way. You need to take baby steps sometimes, and sometimes you look for the lowest hanging fruit first. The police department should be providing the data of where all these illegal guns are coming from and then start with that. So, for instance, I believe Chicago did a study on that recently, and they said that the guns are coming from, Indiana and all the other places outside of Chicago. Well, then once you have an idea about where these things are coming in from, and then you can do attack them. But you know what? I said, like the president or not, his attacks on Baltimore and Chicago actually brought out a lot of good things in the respect that people are talking about this. People are starting to be focused on it. When you have... Think about exponentially, guys, how many people you're looking at right now, 300 young, pretty much all young men who have been murdered in Baltimore.
Tragic.
Who will never have any families, their kids won't have any families. Think about the exponential part of that, all those people in the future that will never exist anymore because of these killings.
Tragic.
Over the last five years.
And Joe, and as we wrap up, in addition to that, really a startling stat in the paper today, not in addition to the 300 homicides, another 1,000 non-fatal victims of violence. So, listen, we don't expect everybody to agree with all our guests when we come on, but you have been thought-provoking. You at least have ideas. You have solutions. We thank you enough. Nestor, who we've been talking with?
Professor Joe Giacalone is a adjunct in the law, police science, and criminal justice administration department. He is a retired New York PD detective sergeant. He wrote an op-ed at the Baltimore Sun, Apathy and Ignorance on Baltimore Crime. It's from October the 22nd. You can go backwards and find that if you're a Sun subscriber out there. Joe, appreciate your time, and I'm glad I got the pronunciation. Joe Giacalone, appreciate you at the John Jay College, and we'll try to stay in touch with you, all right? Appreciate you.
Thanks a lot, fellas.
You got a John Jay College of Criminal Justice, I should say, teaching there after a long and storied career, and a very outspoken person on all things policing. We are Baltimore Positive. We're going to be at Jennings Cafe again very, very soon, as well as down the street at State Fair with our pal Evan. I'll have some chicken and waffles there. Jennings Burger went over nice with Matt Scurra last month as well. Throughout the holiday season, we're going to be putting together a few of these Baltimore Positive episodes that are a little bit off of our usual trio of sit-downs. And, of course, we're going to be back at Fadley's at Lexington Market with Police Commissioner Harrison coming up. He is Don Moeller. I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, and Baltimore Positive. We never stop looking for solutions here in the Charm City.